Hello, you are listening to our inaugural podcast for America Unchained. My name is Chris Tidwell, and I'm joined today by my co-host Richard Dean Winfield, a candidate for U.S. Senate from Georgia. Today, as a nation, I see and we see that we face some of the largest challenges we have ever seen in our history. The extreme wealth inequality in our country, a crippling health crisis, and the constant renewal of open wounds from our past seem to all contribute to keeping our democracy today in shackles. Our podcast, this podcast, aims to unlock some of the means towards a brighter democracy through our social rights agenda, what we consider a social rights agenda. Richard, you ran for U.S. Congress in 2018, talking about a federal work guarantee and the ilk, and now you're running for Senate this year on a even more robust platform given the recent updates. So I'm wondering, what led you to commit to this campaign originally, and what drives you to continue doing it?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, you know, we in the United States and the world at large is in a crisis that is showing itself in what is happening with the coronavirus epidemic, and also what is happening in the wake of the accompanying global economic depression. These are exhibiting shortcomings in the projects of contemporary democracies. And those shortcomings are perhaps most acute in the United States, because despite the fact that we are the oldest continually functioning democracy in the world, with the oldest constitution that is still in use, we have neglected to recognize and enforce our family and social rights. Instead, our body politic and the constitution on which it resides is committed to an array of rights that are restricted to rights pertaining to the use of property and civil legality and to the exercise of a form of representative democracy. And there is no mention nor any consistent attempt to uphold the rights that allow us to function freely as family members and as members of society. And without those rights being recognized and upheld, we really cannot function as equal participants in self-government. And the reason for that is very easy to see. If one is subject to forms of domination in the household and in society, which block the equal opportunity of adults in the household and outside the household, in the economy, in the workings of civil legality, then those blockages of opportunity are going to transfer themselves into the political arena and prevent people from not only being able to take care of the welfare of their households and to have economic independence, but it will prevent them from really wielding equal opportunity and equal participation in the workings of democracy itself.
Right. So the history of our nation often is defined partly by the way that we deal with civil and political rights. Could you maybe outline exactly what the difference is between an economic right or social rights or family rights, as you call it, and the typical American civil or political right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what has exposed the difference and also the deficiency of freedom in the United States. And that is what has happened in the course of our history, where there have been waves of civil rights movements, which have been attempting to ensure that the rights that we are accorded in the Constitution are actually available to everyone. Because as we all know, when the American Republic made its debut, despite the fact that our Constitution makes really no mention of gender, of race, or of class, at the outset, the only people who could fully exercise the civil and political rights laid out in our Constitution were white men who had a certain amount of property.
Right.
Now, there have been waves of movements that have attempted to make our democracy consistent with those rights that are accorded in our Constitution. So that we have seen, for example, property qualifications for political participation and voting removed in the early 19th century. We've seen, obviously, through the workings of the Civil War and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the opening of political participation and equal treatment in the courts and the abolition of slavery to be something that is at least in principle to be accorded to people irrespective of their race. We've seen women's suffrage being successfully implemented. We've seen rights of citizenships eventually being accorded to Native Americans and to other people of color. But as all of these different forms of civil rights battles have come closer to success, and the last of those would be the struggles to free marriage from limitation to heterosexual partners, what we've seen with the achievement of these successes in civil rights movements is that they do not remove the underlying social inequalities that the restrictions on full participation in property relations, in civil rights, and in political participation have imposed on individuals. So that, to put it in a nutshell, as Martin Luther King did, after the great successes of the civil rights movement in achieving the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act in the mid-60s, you know, he said that if you don't have a job and income, you've neither life nor liberty nor the ability to engage in the pursuit of happiness. By failing to uphold the rights to a job at fair wages, to sufficient income if you can't work, to decent housing, to education at all levels, to a clean environment, to health care, to be able to have representation in all kinds of legal cases. Without these social rights being recognized and accorded to individuals, the abiding inequalities that people have suffered because of historical restrictions and which have not been lifted by the success of the civil rights movements, these inequalities and blockages of equal opportunity have only intensified because we've failed to recognize and fulfill these social rights. And we are seeing that very acutely now in face of the pandemic and the economic collapse that has accompanied it.
Right. I think one of the best examples of, I mean, despite the pandemic, the Florida legislature had moved to actually try and reinstate some of the voting rights to felons. But packed within that bill, there was also a, similar to what you were saying earlier, wealth requirement and also having to have a certain level of identification. And basically, it seems that there's, even despite a certain level of law saying, yes, this body has the ability to vote, there's these blockages, like you're saying, that a lot of people in our government today will try and exacerbate. There's different ways that state governments can meddle with the law, such as gerrymandering, or even further than that, to try and suppress the vote. So despite it being even a clear-cut issue on paper, in reality, oftentimes there's social determinants that surround these problems that make them much more difficult than they seem originally. And to me, that's the maybe a less grand way to put it, but for me, that seems to be most important, that there's so much more than just simply the right to vote, to have a full functioning democracy, and that's what we're trying to ensure.
I mean, a very obvious aspect of the way in which our political rights are hobbled by the social inequities that have not been addressed is something that applies to any candidate for an office where campaigning requires a full-time involvement. Essentially, if you run for office, for example, to run for the House of Representatives, as I did in 2018, or to run for the U.S. Senate, you pretty much have to take off from other activities And if you're an employee, you have three strikes against you. Because first of all, you have to, in a way, walk away from your job, which means you have no income for the duration of the campaign. In the United States, to a degree that applies more than in other developed countries, if you lose your job, you lose essential benefits such as healthcare. Mm-hmm. So not only do you lose your income, you lose your ability to take care of your health and that of your family. And on top of that, if you end up losing at the end of the campaign, you can't count on having work awaiting you because there's no guarantee that your employer will be required or will be willing to put you back to work. So this has the effect of making it almost impossible for any of the 95% of Americans who earn a living as employees to really run for office. And you see this reflected in who our office holders are. They're by and large people who have either independent means or they have an independent occupation. They're lawyers, they're doctors, they're business people, etc. But everyone else is in real terms excluded from exercising the right to run for office.
That's right. In some ways, I mean, you're risking your life to run for office if you need that healthcare support constantly, which is a dramatic thing to say, but true. So you talk about work a lot and its relation to running to office, but you also run on a work platform, one that is trying to promote a federal work guarantee, federal jobs guarantee. I remember back in 2018, you ran on a campaign to do something, and that still stands as a core of your campaign. What is the history of that? I mean, I know a little bit about the work program from FDR and the similar programs that people have tried to institute, basically a state-imposed a body that allows that to pick up slack of unemployment in the private sector. So it would be a way to supplement the private sector's employment supply. I mean, I've talked to people about this, and a simple way to put this topic that I've always found is it seems to... It would be nice if we could have people planting flower beds in the downtown of your local city. And I mean, simple things like that could put people back to work. Just could you give me maybe a little bit of an overview of your conception of the federal jobs guarantee?
Yeah. Let me in a way have us look back at what I think are three decisive moments in American history, which each involved, in some respect, a great loss opportunity. One, the first is at the end of the Civil War, when for a brief moment, it appeared that there could be a reconstruction of the nation that would accord to the former slaves full rights, at least the rights that were accorded the other members of the body politic. And the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the 13th, which ended slavery, the 14th, which basically accorded equal protection to people irrespective of race, and the 15th, which provided voting rights irrespective of race. These, in a sense, consistent applications of the rights in our Constitution were recognized by the leaders of the emancipated slaves to not be sufficient. Mm-hmm. They demanded two other things that I think are important in understanding why we need a federal job guarantee. They recognized that they would not be able to really exercise their freedoms if they couldn't have any kind of economic independence. And this, in a sense, required two things. They had to have the means of subsistence, and they had to be able to have access to education, which had been barred to slaves and anyone in the African American community at that time, in many places. Now, the demand for these rights is a demand for rights that are not to be found in our Constitution. There is no right for an individual to have the basic foundation of economic independence, that is to be able to earn a living. Mm-hmm. Nor is there any right in our Constitution to education. That's right. But the former slaves demanded these two things, and they demanded the fulfillment of the right to economic independence, and you could say to basic economic opportunity, by demanding land and livestock to enable them to become independent farmers. Now, in a way, that is something different from what a federal job guarantee does, but it reflects the situation in the South and other parts of the country, where there really was not much of a market for free labor. There were not, in other words, jobs available where one could seek employment. The plantation economy of the South had pretty much starkly limited the availability of those kinds of employments because slaves were doing most of the work. And so it seemed that since the government was not going to step in and put people to work, that was not part of the agenda, that the only way of obtaining economic independence was by having a kind of land reform, mm-hmm. of distributing the confiscated plantations of Confederate sympathizers and landholders and slave owners and distributing them to the freed slaves and their families, which was done on a partial basis by General Sherman. There were plans to do it. They were advanced in various times during Reconstruction, but it was never implemented. There was public education instituted in the South for the first time, but as we all know, it became separate and very unequal. But in any event, this presented this demand, this recognition, that one really couldn't exercise one's civil and political freedoms if one did not have social freedom, if one could not escape social oppression, if one could not have a fulfillment of economic opportunity. Now, this also came to the head as a demand that was recognized to be essential during World War II, at a time when the Allies were seeing victory closing in, that in other words, they had succeeded in protecting the democracies that they enjoyed to the extent that they were democratic. But Roosevelt warned us in his final address to Congress in 1944 that the rights provided by our Constitution are not enough. We need a new Bill of Rights. A new Bill of Rights that would provide a right to a job at fair wages, a right to health care, a right to education at all levels, a right to be able to have access to all aspects of culture, a right to decent housing, a right to have food and clothing, a right as well to be able to have the resources to fight for one's rights in the courts. But that agenda was not acted upon. You had, during the New Deal, various efforts to partially implement some of these demands. And that brings us to the first attempt to really implement the idea of a federal job guarantee, because you had, during the Depression, measures that were put forward as emergency measures, where you had WPA, the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Project Administration, and several mm-hmm. other programs of that sort, where the government stepped in directly to put eventually 11.5 million people to work. And you spoke a little bit about the sort of things that could be done. Well, they set about achieving electrification throughout the country. They built hundreds of thousands of buildings for public use. They built roads and infrastructure of all sorts. They built, of course, great hydroelectric facilities. They brought culture of all sorts with hundreds of thousands of performances of theater, of music. They wrote all sorts of books that would serve the public. But all of these measures were terminated when almost full employment was achieved thanks to the biggest public work project of all, which was World War II.
Right.
But when World War II ended, then America faced what any nation faces that has a mixed economy with both a private and public sector. Namely, the private sector can never guarantee that everyone has a job. And that's for the simple reason that competition is of such a character that firms are required to continually, in a sense, update and try to improve the efficiency of their production and marketing processes. Hmm. And there's always a kind of introduction of new techniques and the, in a sense, dismembering of old techniques, laying off of workers, firms going in and out of business. So there never can be a guarantee of full employment.
So in some ways,
want to reckon, yeah, go on.
In some ways, you're saying there's somewhat of an initiative of the private sector to, or incentive to not fully employ. I mean, this is something that's, I don't know, it could be a big claim, but.
I mean, for example, many people will speak about the private sector and entrepreneurs in particular, whoever they may be, being the job creators. But, you know, entrepreneurs are compelled by the dynamics of competition,
right,
to increase their profits because they need the revenues to invest in order to make themselves competitive. And that can often involve, in a sense, laying off workers when they're faced with overcapacity, or transferring their manufacturing to other places with lower rates of wages,
mm-hmm,
in other countries, or introducing automation and letting go workers, or alternately selling off the assets of the company in order to raise the value of the stock portfolio of the investors in the company. So there are all these ways in which the workings of competition turn entrepreneurs and profit-seeking enterprises into job destroyers.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you could say that the employees, in a way, are the job creators because they spend most of their income on goods and services. And in that way, they are, in a way, multiplying a business activity.
Right.
And providing the effective consumer demand, which allows business to flourish and put people to work. Now, when we speak about this problem of an insecurity of having a job, you have to recognize that that is really the rock bottom of economic independence, because for those people who make up a very small minority of Americans or individuals in any mixed economy, you know, when they fail to earn a living as entrepreneurs or as landlords, they have one thing to fall back on. And it's something that everyone has with the abolition of slavery, namely ownership of their own labor power.
Mm-hmm.
They are in a position, in other words, to go get a job. But there's no guarantee that there will be a job or that that job will pay sufficient wages to live decently.
Right.
Now, the need, therefore, for there to be a real guarantee of jobs at fair wages as a basis for being able to exercise our other freedoms, because if you can't survive economically, you can't take care of your family or engage in politics. Well, this was something that was put forward again after the triumphs of the civil rights movement, when Martin Luther King, having won the Nobel Prize, you know, he could have rested on his laurels in the last year of his life, but instead he launched a poor people's campaign, which was directed at doing something that was already on the table on the march in Washington. And that was the idea of turning to these social rights that we as a nation have neglected. And the anchor of the fulfillment of those social rights was a federal job guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin Luther King was putting that up front. And of course, he died and was shot down when he went to ally with the efforts of the striking sanitation workers in Memphis. Now, 6 years after his death, his widow, Coretta Scott King, launched another effort to initiate a federal job guarantee. She set up an organization for full employment. And it organized demonstrations and marches in more than 300 cities that involved 1.5 million people. But Congress did not listen. Congress passed a very inadequate bill, the name is slipping my mind, the Humphrey Hawkins bill,
mm-hmm,
which gave goals for moving towards full employment, but no real strict announcement of that being a right, which had to be fulfilled. And so here we are, 50 years later, in the richest nation in human history, now suffering the greatest unemployment we have ever faced. It's well above 40%.
Right.
It's reaching 50%. With the economic ramifications of the pandemic and the failure of our national leadership to deal with it effectively. Now is a time when, you know, people are losing their livelihoods and the market is not in the position to respond. You know, you can reopen businesses, but they're not going to be able to be successful when two things are in place, when people still have a reasonable reason to fear going to these businesses, when we haven't had sufficient testing to identify the people who are carrying the virus and then to trace their contacts and isolate people and really limit the contagion. And when secondly, people don't have money to spend because we have these unheard of levels of unemployment following this economic collapse. Now is a time for government to step in.
Right. Well, one thing that has been done already is the implementation of the CARE Act and receiving different funds. And some people have actually found it easier to stay unemployed with a certain basic income, as it could be called. I mean, I think in some ways this response, the response to the COVID crisis, has shown what a potential UBI could look like. That's a universal basic income. And people have been talking about it in EU has been talking about doing it recently as well. In what ways do you see this response falling short? Because it seems like you're still adamant about the inability to spend and all these other structural issues that have come from it. Why is UBI not the answer? Why would a job guarantee be?
Yeah. Now we'll talk about the pros and cons of UBI and a federal job guarantee in one of our later podcasts. But I want to say the following here.
Okay.
We are under special conditions where many workplaces have not been able to reopen safely. And for that reason, the option of putting people to work with the government funding payroll, either funding the payroll of private corporations or directly employing people. You know, there are situations where it's difficult to do so with adequate distancing and adequate personal protective equipment, especially when the government has failed to mobilize producers to furnish sufficient supplies of all of these necessary things, nor to provide sufficient contact tracers to be able to keep things safe. So in a certain sense, you know, we can't put everyone back to work immediately because the conditions do not allow work to be safe.
Right, it's the danger
on the other
of
hand,
the virus.
Yeah, but on the other hand, we have had millions of people who are working in so-called essential jobs, and we can't have them cease working. There are risks. You know, we're talking about people who work in government, in police, fire, in health care industries, in food supply, in all the transportation industries, and all those people who maintain housing and our infrastructure and so forth, all of which, you know, cannot cease. And measures have to be taken to ensure that their work is as safe as possible, which our government has failed to do. Mm-hmm. But now we have to implement it. And we also have to give employees sufficient power to ensure that employers are complying with the necessary requirements for work to be safe. But on the other hand, we then have to move as quickly as possible to have businesses open, but safely, which requires that there be frequent testing of employees and customers, and that there be mass contact tracing of anyone who tests positive, and paid quarantining. Mm-hmm. We also have to institute paid leave so people can shelter at home. And of course, we have to expand such things as broadband so that as many people as possible can work remotely and study remotely. And these are things to which the government can put people to work to provide that kind of infrastructure, just as back in the days of the Great Depression, Roosevelt put people to work electrifying communities. We need now to bring broadband to all communities. But you have to recognize when we talk about giving people a livelihood in situations where we can't put everyone to work, we're not talking about a basic income.
Mm-hmm.
Because a basic income is a poverty income. I mean, Yang proposed, like many other advocates of basic income, $1,000 a month. Well, that's less than the poverty income that is provided to people under Social Security. The average Social Security retirement payment is $1,400 a month. For people on disability is $1,200 a month. You cannot live on that, according to the government's own figures. In no American city can anyone be able to afford an apartment unless they're making at least $20 an hour. And that comes to about $3,500 a month, or close to $42,000 a year. So if we're going to be talking about providing funds to people under the extreme circumstances we are in now, funds that allow them to maintain their livelihood, to pay their rent, and of course to be able to eat and clothe themselves and have adequate child and elder care, we're not talking about a basic income, we're talking about a fair income, a replacement income that is a matter of right and that should be given to everyone who is not in a position to be able to work. Mm-hmm. But for those who can work, we need to find ways of putting them to work. Because one of the ultimate problems that we face in providing funds to people and providing funds both to employees and to entrepreneurs is that there is a risk of inflation. That in other words, if you throw money into the system, but there's nothing to buy or there's too little to buy or there's no renewal of production or the investments being made with this money are not in a way increasing production,
right,
then prices can explode. We could risk hyperinflation. So it is important to renew economic activity,
right,
and put people to work. We cannot just have UBI, and the UBI should not be B with for basic. It should be a fair income. And that is something that can be sustained by the creation of wealth that, in a way, is brought to a peak when we have full employment.
Right. And I mean, there also seems to be a certain level of enjoyment both by the general population, body politic, from the products that are produced by these guaranteed jobs. I mean, like the simple example that I gave, like having flower beds would benefit everybody, but it's so much more than that. All these potential jobs, like infrastructure, would be a day-to-day interaction with the vast majority of Americans.
I can tell you from my experience as a candidate, going out into the far-flung districts of Georgia's 10th congressional district, you know, the infrastructure and the conditions of life are severely hobbled by a failure in public investment. You know, we need to put people to work, not only to extend broadband to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see how crucial that is in terms of a pandemic especially.
Right.
But also generally speaking, to be able in this modern society to exercise your rights, you need to be able to access the internet and have the facilities to do so.
Mm-hmm.
We also are sorely lacking in public transportation. People are stranded, not only in cities, but outside of cities particularly. And there, you know, our infrastructure is falling to pieces. We also need to put people to work to provide robot-proof public services. And now we need to employ hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, as contact tracers so we can really effectively contain the pandemic.
Right, it's a ready job.
Yeah, and of course we have to buttress our health facilities, our educational facilities, our child and elder care facilities, half of which are facing bankruptcy and the inability to reopen in the economic crisis that we're in. You know, our government has to step in,
right,
and ensure that these things are being provided for and we can make the public investment to do so.
Right. And I guess to go back to maybe who potentially would get these jobs, because you have to think about that when you're trying to institute policy, who's going to enjoy it primarily. And in fact, the history from a little bit earlier, mentioning Dr. King and his promotion of a Poor People's Campaign and thereby Coretta Scott King's promotion of the National Committee for Full Employment, it gives proof to a problem that we're still facing, which is a racial history of low unemployment, one where there's a disproportionate effect on Black and brown people in comparison to the white population. And in COVID, speed up forward, in COVID, we see the fact that these jobs, these essential workers, they wind up being Black and brown people predominantly, the people that are working at your grocery store, the people that are giving you your medication, and the people that have to wear the most masks wind up being the people that are at most risk. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk about that dimension of the work guarantee and also its relation to COVID.
Yeah, and by the way, another group that straddles racial groups that has a disproportionate representation in essential work are women.
Right.
Who obviously are very important in all sorts of healthcare situations and care situations in general.
Elder care in particular.
Elder care, et cetera, child care, mm-hmm. and also in, you know, many of the facilities that are hardest hit. We've all heard that the degree of contagion and the amount of deaths have been disproportionately suffered by people of color, by African Americans and Hispanics.
About 357 times, or we'll say percentage, 357 percentage of comparison. So 3.5 times and some change of death.
And I think that the disproportionate toll among people in color reflects the disproportionate blockage of opportunity that these communities have suffered. And they are directly linked to the increased vulnerability of these groups to this pandemic and to the economic crisis that has ended up accompanying it in the United States. First of all, there is the general health risk that's faced by people in these groups. Generally speaking, there is a difference of almost 20 years in the lifespan between people from higher groups of affluence and people on the bottom mm-hmm. of the economic spectrum. And the poverty rate of African Americans is 3 times that of white Americans. And the poverty rate of Hispanics and Native Americans is close to that as well. So, you know, why does poverty play that role in this country? Well, it has to do with the fact that we don't offer health care to people independent of money. You have to pay for it in one form or another. And that's true even if you're covered by Medicare and Medicaid, mm-hmm. because there are still co-pays and deductibles that people cannot afford. And many people who have health insurance owing to their employment cannot pay to use it because of co-pays and deductibles. So basically you have among people of color conditions of health where they have less access to healthcare. They also suffer from, in a sense, the health effects of poverty and discrimination. Obviously, stress itself is a factor that reduces our immunity. And there is stress in being poor, living on the edge. There is stress in being continually the object of discrimination and police brutality, for that matter. Mm-hmm. You know, these are bad for one's health, and they take a toll far beyond that of, for example, police killings. And we're talking about a toll that is represented also in obesity, higher rates of obesity, and asthma, and I mentioned diabetes, and also, of course, we allow poor people to be living in communities where we dump our highly polluting industries and power plants. So they're more highly affected by pollution,
right?
Both in air quality and water quality and so forth, which also makes them more susceptible to a death toll, higher death toll with regard to the COVID. But then there's the other side of it, which is they are less likely to be able to carry on work remotely because it's higher income positions, such as a university professor who can continue to earn a living teaching remotely, or people who are office workers in higher income positions, or lawyers, or doctors, or professionals of various kinds. Whereas the types of employment, the lower paid employments that people of color are more likely to be in, cannot work remotely. They find themselves under a compulsion to have to go back to work, even if work is not safe, because they're going to starve or become homeless if they're not already homeless. And also they're working in so-called essential industries, in healthcare, in transportation, in food industries, and the like. And the problem is our government, together with employers, have not supplied their workers with sufficient safety measures, PPEs, distancing, paid leave, contact tracing. So these people who are predominantly people of color and women find themselves in work situations where they are in likely contact with people who are infected and they have no way of protecting themselves.
Right.
And these are key reasons why the death toll of people of color is disproportionately great. And there's another side to it. And that is the testing that is taking place is not taking place in those communities which are suffering the greatest amounts of contagion. Donald Trump and his staff get tested for the coronavirus every day. Healthcare workers are not getting tested every day. People working in supermarkets are not getting tested every day. People driving buses and public transportations, trains, commuter trains and whatever, subways are not getting tested every day. People in communities of color, which are having larger rates of contagion, are not getting tested every day, nor is there contact tracing going on. So they are suffering from inequities in the distribution of the safety measures that follow upon the contagion.
Right.
And that's why reopening without these measures being taken is something that puts at risk the lives of Black people, Hispanic people, women in general, and others who are most likely to be exposed to the coronavirus under these conditions.
And it seems due time that the state starts taking up this as a social responsibility instead of deferring it to a personal responsibility. I mean, that was maybe one of the biggest issues that racial rhetoric has, is that oftentimes it gets deferred to being their fault. But in fact, we can see through the through line we've tracked so far that there's a history and a future of this inequality that needs to be rectified.
I mean, there's been two massive failures on the part of our federal government. That's really the federal government that has to step in national mobilizations. On the one hand, it has not provided the mass testing, the PPE equipment, the contact tracing, and so forth. It would have allowed us to nip the pandemic in the bud, as other nations have successfully done. They failed in that regard. And because of that, we had to engage in massive shutdowns that other nations did not have to do. But in connection with that, our government failed to provide income to everyone. Other countries publicly funded payrolls. So even if businesses could not operate, their employees were being fully funded.
Right.
We failed to do that. And for that reason, there is this popular pressure to reopen even when it's not safe to do so, because people are not freely wanting to go back to work in unsafe conditions. They are forced to,
right,
because they are broke, they are hungry, and they are facing mass evictions and foreclosures. And the failure of our government has created a situation where if we'd instead had a federal job guarantee and all the income replacements that go with it, as well as access to broadband for everyone, access to healthcare for everyone, we would not have this kind of individualistic striving to throw off precautions and feeling that, well, we have a right to return to work. Well, you know, freedom is not something that involves putting the lives and health of others at risk. One does not have a right to do so. And we have to recognize that when we fail to take the precautions ourselves, in the current case of the pandemic, it's not just that we're putting ourselves at risk. In many cases, if you're young and healthy, the risks you face are not that great. But you're putting at risk your parents, your grandparents, and anyone else in our community has a kind of vulnerabilities in health that, by the way, disproportionately afflict people of color in this country.
Right. Well, that seems to be about the time that we have for today's episode. But I think we covered a lot of ground, and hopefully we will have a good follow-up. So stay tuned for the next episode.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
And I look forward to our next weekly session.